That gas mask is a wonderfully realistic touch.
It's not realistic, said Vivian. It's real.
She found her shoes and packed her suitcase yet again, while Jonathan took his grey flannel disguise and hid it in a stone chest. They'll be safe enough there until Sam can sneak them back to patrol costumes, he said. Oh, and take that label off the string thing. It'll look pretty funny if I introduce you as V.S. Lee and you're waving a label saying V. Smith. This was true, but Vivian felt a twinge of alarm as the label went into the stone chest too. It was as if she really had lost her name. How am I going to prove to Cousin Marty that I'm me? She wondered, putting on her school hat and her coat.
Now I am ready, she said.
The house was huge, with a sort of lived-in richness to it. The rugs along the passages had an ugly, valuable look, but they had worn places in them. The banisters of the many stairs they went down had been polished so much that the carvings on them had almost worn away. The stairs had dips in the middle, from countless years of feet. People were hard at work putting another layer of polish on them. Jonathan took Vivian on a dodging, zigzag way down, using four different staircases, so that they never met any of these people face to face, and they came at last to the ground floor. Jonathan let out a sigh of relief. Now we can let people see us, he said. Vivian looked from the coloured marble patterns on the floor to the wide oak stairway, and then to a row of pointed windows or maybe doors on the other side. She could see a sloping town square out there with a fountain in the middle.
What is this house? She said.
The Annuit Palace, said Jonathan. This way. He took Vivian along the patterned marble floor to where the space stopped being a front hall and turned into a kind of room full of carved, empty frames that were probably chairs. Just beyond an archway, a lady was speaking into what was probably a telephone, though it looked rather as if she was gazing into a mirror and speaking into a magnifying glass.
I'll be along in 5 minutes, she said,
glancing at Jonathan and Vivian.
And we'll sort it out then. Something seems to have come up here. Bye.
She put the magnifying glass into a slot by the mirror and turned round, staring at Vivian. Vivian suddenly felt truly uncomfortable. This lady had the same deeply anxious look that Mum had worn ever since war was declared. And though she looked nothing like Mum, since she had the same folded eyes as Jonathan, with the same flicker in front of them, Vivian knew she was a real person with real worries, just like Mum. She might wear yellow and black pyjamas and do her hair in a strange way, but it was not right to lie to her. And here was Jonathan, smoothly telling her lies. "You'll never guess, Mother," he said. "This is Cousin Vivian, Vivian Lee. She's just got here from 20th century." His mother put up a hand and clutched her jetty black hair.
"Oh, great time! Are the Lees back already, then? I meant to air Lee House first."
"No, no, she's on her own. Viv and Inga sent her back because World War II's just started," Jonathan explained. "And here I am, standing here letting him lie," Vivian thought uncomfortably. But she had to join in the lying after that, because Jonathan's mother turned to her with a worried smile.
"Of course. That war comes up about a third of the way through 20th century, doesn't it? Has it turned out worse than they expected?" "Much worse," said Vivian. "London's being bombed quite a bit already. They think there's going to be gas attacks and an invasion soon."
Though all this was quite true, It somehow amounted to a lie. Jonathan's mother turned pale.
"They're sending all the children away from London,"
Vivian said, hoping that this would make her feel better.
"You poor child, and my poor brother,"
Jonathan's mother said.
"Why does everything have to happen at once? Of course, you must stay here with us until your parents are recalled. And we'll find you some proper clothes. I suppose you've nothing but those awful things you've got on."
Vivian looked down at her coat and her best skirt rather indignantly. But she did not need to say anything. Jonathan's mother turned back to the telephone thing and pressed the knob in the wall beside it.
"Elio,"
she said,
"I need you at once. Can you come to the hall?"
She said over her shoulder to Jonathan,
"Will you take care of Vivian today, my love, and show her around and so on? She's bound to feel very strange after 5 years in history. I've got a crisis on in age long. Someone sent out the new Australian grammar to Malaya nearly a century before it was invented, and I'm going to be all day sorting it out."
"I always have to do your dirty work,"
Jonathan said, pretending to be annoyed.
"You're never here at all."
"I know, my love,"
his mother said, looking more worried than ever.
"I'll try to get the day off tomorrow. I..."
But here, a door slammed open across the room, and a tall, anguished-looking man came storming out in a swirl of grey robes. He was followed by a pale, respectful-looking man in sober, fawn-coloured pyjamas. Jonathan's mother instantly turned more worried yet.
"What's this? What's going on?" asked the storming man. "You can't take Elio away now. I need him."
He glared at the pale man, who looked at the floor respectfully. He glared at Jonathan, who looked back as if he was used to it. Then he came right up to Vivian and glared at her.
"What in time's name is this?" he said.
His pepper-coloured hair was scraped into a knob on the top of his head, and his eyes stared out of deep, hollow sockets, looking agonised. He was so alarming that Vivian backed away.
"It's little Vivian Lee, Ranjit,"
Jonathan's mother said in a guilty, soothing way.
"Your niece. The Lees have had to send her home because 20th century seems to be getting quite dangerous, and she'll have to stay with us. Their house is shut up, remember. I wanted Elio to see about a room and some clothes for her."
"But she's too big,"
the anguished man said, still glaring at Vivian.
"This girl is not the right size."
Vivian stood limply, looking at the floor like the pale man. It was almost a relief that he had realized she was not the right Vivian. Now she would not need to lie any more. But she was very scared about what they would do to her now they knew.
"She was 6 when she went away, father,"
Jonathan said. He did not seem in the least alarmed.
"That was nearly 6 years ago. Think how much I've changed since then."
"So you have,"
said this alarming man, turning his glare on Jonathan, as if he did not think the change was for the better.
"I see," he said. "She grew."
And to Vivian's great surprise, he turned to her again, with his anguished face relaxed into a charming smile. The hint of anguish still there in his hollow eyes only seemed to make the smile more charming. He held out a long, knobby hand for Vivian to shake.
"I believe that to be 20th century custom," he said. "How do you do, my dear?"
"Very well, thank you,"
Vivian managed to say. Relief seemed to have taken her voice away at first. No wonder Jonathan thought I'd better have breakfast before I met his father, she thought. I might have fainted without. Jonathan's father turned round, saying,
"I need Elio back in 5 minutes exactly,"
and went away in the same storming way that he had come, with his robes streaming
and banged the door behind him. Jonathan's mother took pale Elio aside and began telling him what she needed. She seemed quite flustered, but Elio nodded calmly. He had a little square thing in his hand and punched buttons on it respectfully as Jonathan's mother talked. It must have been a way of taking notes.
"What do I call them?"
Vivian whispered urgently to Jonathan while his mother talked.
"Call who what?" said Jonathan. "Your parents. Auntie what? Uncle which?"
Vivian whispered.
"Oh, I see,"
Jonathan whispered.
"Her name's Jenny Lee Walker. You'd better say Jenny. He's called Ranjit Walker. Most people call him Sempiturn, but you're supposed to be a Lee, so you could call him Ranjit."
"Ranjit," Vivian tried out to herself. "Uncle Ranjit." It was no good. She could just not imagine herself calling that alarming man anything. Jenny was better, she could manage that. But she did wonder if Jonathan was being very brave or just mad to think of deceiving either of them. Jonathan's mother, Jenny, Vivian told herself, turned back to them, smiling.
"That's all seen to, then," she said. "Leave your coat and hat and your luggage here, Vivian dear, for Elio to see to, and run off and enjoy Time City with Jonathan. Or—"
She looked worried again.
"Do you need anything to eat?"
"No, thanks,"
Vivian said, and once more found herself lying by telling the truth.
I had sandwiches to take on the train."
Then they were free to go back along the coloured marble floor. Vivian went feeling rather shaky, but Jonathan walked with a bouncing, lordly stride, smiling broadly.
"There, we got away with it," he said.
"I knew we would.
This way."
He swung towards the line of pointed windows. They clearly were doors. One in the middle flapped aside to let them out, as if it knew they were coming. Or Vivian thought it was opening for them until she saw that two people, a man and a woman, were coming in from the square outside. Vivian stopped politely to let them come in first. But to her astonishment, Jonathan took no notice of them at all. He went on walking through the opening as if the two people did not exist. And to Vivian's utter horror, he walked straight through both of them, the man first and then the woman, as if they were made of smoke.
How did you do that?"
she gasped, as the man and woman walked past her through the hall, looking quite whole and undamaged.
Who are they?"
"Those? Oh, you don't want to take any notice of those," Jonathan said. "They're only time ghosts."
Vivian's still shaky legs nearly folded under her.
"Ghosts,"
she squawked. Chapter 3. Time City. Jonathan took Vivian's elbow and towed her down a bank of stone steps into the cobbled square outside.
"Not really ghosts," he said. "Time ghosts. And you're supposed to know about them, so don't make such a noise. This square is called Time Close. All the important people live here. That's Lee House over there, where you were supposed to have been born."
How can anyone get used to ghosts? Vivian thought, looking where Jonathan pointed. Lee House was the tallest building on the right-hand side of Time Close. It confused Vivian a little because it was built mostly of metal, in a most modern-looking style, and yet she could see that it was very old from the gigantic flowering tree trained up the front of it. The tree had reached the straight metal roof and bent across it,
and gone on to trail huge branches over the newer houses on either side. And these houses were built of mellow pink brick and weathered old wood in a way that ought to have been ancient. More confusing still, the Inuit palace, where Vivian turned to look back at it, was simply a very large house built in a style she had never seen before.
"Then tell me about these ghosts, if I'm supposed to know," she said.
"Time ghosts," said Jonathan. "They happen because the city keeps using the same piece of space and time over and over again. If a person does the same thing often enough, they leave a mark in the air, like the ones you just saw. Habit ghosts, we call them. There's another kind called once ghosts. I'll show you some of those later. They get made..."
But the explanation was interrupted by Sam, who came shuffling gloomily away from the fountain in the middle of the close. He was in orange pyjamas today, and his shoelaces were trailing off both feet.
"I got caught. I got hit," he said, sighing gustily.
His face was rather blotchy, as if he might have been crying.
"I was tired," he said. "I took the keys back this morning instead." "Oh, no," exclaimed Jonathan.
His lordly air vanished, and he looked horrified.
"I told you not to. You mean they found out?" "No, I covered up," Sam said. "My dad came in just as I was putting the keys back, and I pretended I was just taking them that moment for a joke. But he hit me and locked his study. We won't be able to get at them again." "That's all right," Jonathan said, much relieved. "We won't need the keys again. I got V.S. passed off as Cousin Vivian, so we're quite safe."
He was far too relieved to show any sympathy for Sam. Vivian felt she ought to make up for it by being sorry for Sam herself, but she was too worried on her own account. This meant there was no chance of forcing Jonathan to send her back to Cousin Marty by the way she had come. She would have to make them send her through another time lock, and soon. She knew she could not pretend to be Cousin Vivian for long. Someone was bound to find out. Jonathan did not seem to be worrying about that at all.
"Tie your shoes up,"
he said confidently to Sam. And when Sam had done so, with much heavy breathing and some cross muttering, Jonathan led the way through an archway in the lower corner of Time Close into a big, empty square beyond.
"This is Eon Square,"
he said, waving a lordly hand. There were huge buildings all round the square. But Vivian was a Londoner and used to tall buildings. What impressed her more was that, in the same confusing way as the buildings in Time Close, the ones which should have been ultra-modern seemed to be the oldest here. There was a great turreted place that might have been a department store, filling all the right-hand side of Eon Square, and it was made entirely of glass. Glass twisted and wrought into 100 futuristic shapes. But Vivian could see, even from this distance, that the glass was pitted and worn, and obviously as old as the hills, while the nearer buildings with stone towers looked much newer.
"What do you think of it?"
Jonathan said, clearly expecting her to marvel.
"It's not much bigger than Trafalgar Square, without Nelson and the lions,"
Vivian said, refusing to be overawed.
"But it's awfully clean."
This was true. There was no soot or grime. The sunlight slanted on clear grey stone and sparkled green on the glass, or came dazzling off the golden roofs and domes that crowded up from behind the buildings at the end of the square. Vivian looked up into the soft blue and white sky as she followed Jonathan across the wide space and found no chimneys and no smoke.
Why is there no smoke?
She asked.
And don't you have pigeons?
No birds in Time City,
Sam said, stumping along behind.
And we don't use fossil fuels, Jonathan said, striding ahead. We use energy functions instead. This is Faber-John's stone.
Right in the middle of the square, there was a big slab of bluish rock let into the whiter paving stones. It was very worn from being walked on. The golden letters that had once made up quite a long inscription had been almost totally trodden away. Sam stood and gazed at it.
The cracks got bigger, he announced.
Vivian could see the crack Sam meant. It was quite a short one, from one corner, stretching to the first golden letters of the inscription. F-A-B, they said. I-O-V. A-E-T. I-V. And C-O-N-D-I on the next line. The rest was too worn away to read.
Is it Greek?
She asked.
Latin, said Sam. Measure the crack. Go on.
In a second, said Jonathan.
He explained to Vivian.
They say Faber-John put this stone here when he founded the city. The words mean that Faber-John founded the city to last the four ages. My tutor raves at the way they've let it get trodden away. He thinks it should say why the city was made, and whereabouts the polarities are out in history. The story says that when Faber-John's stone breaks up, the city will break up too.
All right,
he said to Sam, who was bouncing impatiently about. Jonathan put his foot in a green, strappy sandal, carefully along the crack, with his green heel wedged into the corner.
It's grown quite a bit, he said. It's nearly to the end of my toes now.
He said to Vivian,
it was just a little tiny split for most of my life. But it started to grow about a month ago. I measure it every day on my way to school.
The city's breaking up,
Sam announced in a booming, gloomy voice.
I need comforting. I need a 42-century butter pie.
Later,
said Jonathan, and strode away across the square.
I want to show V.S. the time ghosts in Circular Square.
Sam stamped angrily and defiantly on the crack, which caused one of his shoelaces to trail again as he followed them. Circular Square was behind Eon Square, and much smaller. It was crowded with stalls and a red and white awnings, where people were buying and selling everything from fruit and meat to tourist trinkets. At first sight, there were hundreds of people there. Then Vivian's flesh began to creep, as she realized that half the people were walking through the other half. Music was playing merrily somewhere. Everyone was chattering and buying things, and nobody seemed in the least bothered that half the throng were ghosts who chattered and laughed without making a sound, and paid for ghostly apples with unreal money. There was even a ghostly stall, piled with ghostly oranges and tomatoes. It overlapped the real stall, but nobody seemed to mind. That stall was the only ghostly thing Vivian dared walk through.
How do you tell?
She asked despairingly, as Jonathan and Sam walked through a crowd of laughing girls who looked as real as anyone else.
They all look quite solid to me.
You'll get to know, Jonathan said. It's obvious, really.
But I can't go bumping into everyone until I do,
Vivian protested. She kept carefully behind Jonathan and Sam, while she tried to see just what it was about the people they walked through. After a while, she noticed that the people they didn't walk through were all the ones who were wearing the same kind of pajama suits as their own. Got it, Vivian thought. Pajamas are present-day fashion. She pointed excitedly to a group of people in gauzy dresses gathered round a trinket stall.
I know. Those are time ghosts.
Jonathan and Sam looked.
Tourists, said Sam.
From 87th century, said Jonathan.
As they said it, a gauze-robed girl bought a real white bag with Time City on it in gold letters and paid with a real silvery strip of money. Vivian felt a fool. A time ghost in a pink striped crinoline walked through her, and she had suddenly had enough.
This is giving me the pip,
she said.
Go somewhere else or I shall scream.
Let's get butter pies, said Sam.
Later, said Jonathan.
He led the way down a winding lane called Day Alley, explaining to Vivian,
I wanted you to see how old Time City is. There are ghosts in the market wearing clothes that must go back hundreds of years.
I'm miserable,
Sam proclaimed, plodding behind with his shoelace flapping.
Nobody ever gives me butter pies when I need them.
Shut up, said Jonathan. Stop whinging.
This conversation happened so often after that Vivian felt it ought to qualify as a time ghost. Meanwhile, they saw a round place with a golden dome called the Years, and then went over a bridge that was made of china, like a teacup, and painted with flowers in a way that reminded Vivian of a teacup even more. But the paint was worn and scratched, and the bridge was chipped in places. It led to a park called Long Hours, where she saw the famous Pendulum Gardens. Vivian found them fascinating. But Sam stood glumly watching fountains fling water high against the sky, and little islands of rock carrying daffodils, tulips and irises slowly circle about in the spray.
There's only 19 islands left, he said. Two more have come down.
How is it done?
Vivian asked.
How do the flowers stay up?
Nobody knows, said Jonathan. They say Faber John invented it. It's one of the oldest things in the city.
That's why it's falling apart, Sam said dismally.
Oh, do stop being so depressing,
Jonathan snapped at him.
I can't,
sighed Sam.
I'm in my wet, weak mood. You weren't hit before breakfast.
Jonathan sighed too.
Let's go and have some butter pies, he said.
Sam's face lit up. His whole body changed.
Whoopee! Charge! He shouted,
and led the way back to Eon Square at a gallop. Jonathan and Vivian trotted after him, through narrow stone streets, through time ghosts, and past numbers of strangely dressed tourists.
He knows just how to get what he wants,
Jonathan panted irritably. That's the pot calling the kettle black, if I ever heard it, Vivian thought.
How old is he?
She asked.
8,
Jonathan said in a short, disgusted puff of breath.
Sometimes I wish I wasn't stuck with him. But he's the only person anywhere near my age and time close.
Sam galloped straight to the glass building in Aeon Square and trotted along an arcade of glass pillars until he came to a place where tables were set out. He dived into a chair at a table with a view between two enormous greenish pillars and sat proudly waiting to be served. Vivian sat beside him, watching tourists walk through the square and cluster to look at Faber John's stone in the middle. More tourists sat at the other tables, or went in and out of the rich-looking shops under the arcade. Vivian had never seen so many peculiar clothes and strange hairstyles in her life. She heard strange languages, too, jabbering all around her.
Time City relies a lot on the tourist trade, Jonathan said.
Where do they all come from?
Vivian asked.
All the fixed eras,
Sam said, quite cheerful now.
100,000 years of them.
There's a tour for every 10 years of every century, except when there's a war on, Jonathan said. The time consuls arrange them. Time Patrol checks everyone who wants to come, but almost anyone can come, really.
How much does a tour cost?
Vivian asked. But the waitress arrived to take their orders just then. She was a cheerful young lady in frilly pink pyjamas, who clearly knew Sam and Jonathan rather well.
"Hello, you two," she said. "How many butter pies this morning?"